Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, September 30th, 2021. Art enthusiasts will reunite in Marfa for Chinati Weekend, October 8th through 10th. Marfa, the Chinati Foundation / La Fundación Chinati will open its gates to visitors Friday, October 8th through Sunday, October 10th for a weekend of exhibitions, music, food, public programs, and the reopening of the Dan Flavin installation. The 34th iteration of Chinati Weekend will return to in-person attendance after a 2020 virtual festival. Entrance to Chinati and public programs will be free for all. Chinati will require visitors to wear face masks, and further health precautions and requirements will be communicated on Chinati's website as they develop. The weekend begins in downtown Marfa on Friday with an open studio displaying works by artist-in-residence Alan Ruiz at the Locker Plant. That same night, Made in Marfa will return, inviting local creatives to vend their wares throughout town. Entrance to the Chinati Foundation will be free on Saturday and Sunday for open house viewing of the art, architecture, and land that make artist Donald Judd's vision for Chinati unique. On Saturday, the Chinati Weekend program features the opening of special exhibitions of works by Donald Judd, Dan Flavin, and Yong Kin Yoon, a performance by improvisational trombonist David Dove, with an ensemble of musicians, and an artist's talk by Alan Ruiz. Dan Flavin's untitled Marfa Project, 1996, has occasioned four new commissions and a special exhibition. Over the past year, the Flavin installation, one of the foundational works in Chinati's collection, received significant maintenance, as well as a new set of 336 fluorescent lamps. The reopening of the installation over Chinati Weekend will be marked by a series of events. David Dove has composed a new score in response to the installation's acoustical qualities. As visitors travel through the six buildings of Flavin's installation on Saturday, October 8th, they will conduct their own experiences of Dove's immersive performance. This work is being presented with special permission from the estate of Dan Flavin. Alan Ruiz, Chinati's artist in residence, will present new perspectives on Dan Flavin's art relative to Ruiz's own work's interest in the ready-made and networked systems in a public talk on Saturday, October 8th. The Chinati Newsletter, Volume 26, will be launched with an essay by Jennifer Burris on Dan Flavin as a collector and curator, and an artist's project by Leslie Hewitt that reflects on Flavin's use of natural and fluorescent light. A special installation of Dan Flavin's untitled In Memory of My Father, D. Nicholas Flavin, 1974, will open over Chinati Weekend. Comprised of discrete modules of circular fixtures and white fluorescent light, the work will offer a historic contrast to Chinati's large-scale installation of colored light. An open-house supper will be hosted by the Chinati Foundation on Saturday night in the arena. Recognizing that this has been a challenging year for many, this gathering will be an opportunity to enjoy community, a meal, and mariachi under the West Texas sky. Sunday morning starts with sunrise viewings of Judd's 15 untitled works in concrete and 100 untitled works in mill aluminum, followed by open house viewing of the collection. The Chinati Weekend tradition was inaugurated in 1987 by the museum's founder, artist Donald Judd, as a means to bring together Chinati's local, national, and international communities. More than 30 years later, the October weekend has grown to be Chinati's most important annual event and a much-anticipated cultural celebration for the West Texas region, bringing scores of visitors to Marfa for a weekend of free public programs. The Chinati Weekend 2021 program concludes Sunday afternoon, October 10th. To learn more about the weekend's schedule, visit chinati.org. Bustamante. Lauro Joseph Bustamante, 55, entered into eternal rest on September 20th, 2021, where he resided in Clint, Texas. He is preceded in death by his parents, Faustino and Anita Bustamante. Lauro is survived by his beloved wife, Sofia Bustamante, daughters Amanda Pineda, Esmeralda Bustamante, Diana Villalobos, and Laura Padilla, son David Rudy Villalobos, and sisters Marta Torres and Gracie Bustamante. He also leaves behind 9 grandchildren to cherish his memory. The visitation was held on Wednesday, September 29th, and included the rosary officiated by Deacon William Hernandez at Sunset Funeral Home Americas in El Paso. The Mass, officiated by Father Emmanuel Soto, will begin at 11 a.m. on Thursday, September 30th at San El Ciario Catholic Church, 1556 San Elizario Road, San Elizario, Texas, 79849. The Mass, officiated by Father Emmanuel Soto, will begin at 11 a.m. on Thursday, September 30th at San Elizario Catholic Church, 1556 San Elizario Road, San Elizario, Texas, 79849. Services entrusted to Sunset Funeral Home Americas. Ernie Villarreal appointed to MISD School Board. Marfa. At last week's Marfa ISD School Board meeting, Ernie Villarreal was appointed to replace Mark Cash, who recently stepped down from his position. Villarreal will begin his term at the next board meeting on October 25th and will serve until May 2022. The school board selected Villarreal for his administrative experience, which includes almost 15 years at Valentine ISD, where he still serves as the Director of Finance and Tax Assessor Collector. Villarreal is a third-generation Marfan who graduated from Marfa High School in 1999. He received a degree in business administration from Selross State University in 2005. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, he expressed a desire to serve the students and teachers of Marfa ISD while also advocating for facilities maintenance and repairs. "I want to work with current board members, administration, teachers, and staff, and not against them," he said. "I want to give back to the school that has given so much to me." Howland Avenue Construction Nears Midway Point by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Residents and tourists alike have taken notice of the road construction near downtown Marfa, as the project concludes its third week of an estimated 8-week span. At press time, activity was concentrated in front of the fire station. Dean Street remained closed for repaving, with detours directing traffic through the neighborhood east of the courthouse. Previous reporting by the Big Bend Sentinel explained that road improvements span the northern city limit down to the four-way stop. They include revamping the three-way intersection on the south side of the courthouse, adding pedestrian safety and accessibility features on sidewalks, and resurfacing the road with a spray paver to minimize noise and the amount of time the road is closed. The road construction in Marfa is part of the Texas Department of Transportation's U.S. 67 Master Plan, which aims to increase safety and mobility in communities along the highway between Fort Stockton and Presidio Ojinaga. The master plan was developed with community input between 2017 and 2019, recognizing the growth of the region and its importance as a hub for tourism and truck cargo. Marfans are finally starting to see these plans put into action during some of the busiest weeks for tourism of the year. According to Laura Macias Cervantes, a spokesperson for TxDOT, the project is proceeding according to schedule. She explained that the timing for this project was determined by when permits and approvals for proposals could be matched with funding. The process requires coordination between city, state, and county governments, and lining up all the moving parts takes time. We are aware of the importance of tourism to the area and are working with the contractor to complete the project safely and with the least inconvenience to those impacted, Macias Cervantes said. In this case, we have conducted personal outreach to businesses and will implement a faster paving method. Macias Cervantes explained that TxDOT aims to move forward with considerations for parking concerns, access to the fire station, pedestrian traffic, impacts to trees and shrubs along the street, and the designation of the county courthouse as a historic structure. Public involvement is a critical component of TxDOT projects, she said. Kate Calder, the owner of Community on Highland, has had a front row seat to the action on the city's main drag. We were pretty lucky with Trans-Pecos weekend, she said, referring to a busy festival weekend that coincided with a number of road closures. I noticed one day we were down to one lane in front of the shop, and by the next morning both lanes were open again, which we all appreciated because we were looking forward to having a strong weekend. Calder explained that, as part of their outreach, TxDOT had distributed business cards to shop owners on Highland before construction began. She had also begun to see other business owners post construction updates on their websites and social media, but didn't yet feel the need to alert potential shoppers. Recently, a customer came in and one of my co-workers started talking about the construction, and the customer said, "No worries, Austin is always under construction." She went on to say, "Marfa has a pretty limited number of things to do, in a good way, so I think people will still seek out those things, even if they have to move down the street a little differently." Marfa City Council slashes proposed grant writing position, passes budget and tax rate for 2021-2022. By Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, the City Council managed to move its budget up to $24,281.30 net positive at the last minute before passing its final budget for 2021-2022 on Tuesday evening. Immediately after, they passed a 13.07% decrease in the tax rate for the new fiscal year. There was no public input at the city's budget hearing on Tuesday, September 28th, as the council held its last discussions on the city budget and the tax rate. While public participation was down, this year's budget cycle incorporated more involvement from department heads within the city, including meetings with each to hash out what was absolutely needed for the new fiscal year. Still, the budget was only narrowly balanced by the time Tuesday's final budget hearing rolled around. After edits to Mayor Manny Baez's initial proposed budget, the council had left just $281.30. $281 keeps me awake at night, City Manager Mandy Rohn told council during the meeting. The narrow margin meant if any forecasted income fell short, or if unexpected expenses arose, the city would be dipping into its banked savings to cover the difference. It's such a tight budget, I'm thinking about the grant position, said Councilmember Buck Johnston. The newly budgeted position had been hotly debated throughout the budget workshops this summer. Rohn suggested that instead of adding the new grant writer position, she and City Secretary Kelly Perez could take on the responsibility for the leanly budgeted year. In that time, she hoped to meet with department heads to figure out needs, identify grants that could be applied for, and send Perez to a grant writing training. City Attorney Teresa Todd added that the city only needed to apply to the grants, noting that many grants allow for part of the grant funds to be used for administration costs once the grant has been received. The proposed new position had been brought by Councilmember Yosef Ben Yehuda as $50,000 budgeted for a part-time grant writer for the city and earned narrow support early on, but at subsequent meetings, Mayor Pro Tem Irma Salgado proposed reducing it to $24,000 due to the tight budget constraints. On Tuesday, Ben Yehuda urged, "The best time to plant a tree is yesterday. This is an investment, and putting it off another year doesn't make sense." Rohn told council, "It's not the position itself, it's the $281. It's no cushion at all. Something is going to come up, and $281 isn't going to cover it. I know we have banked funds," she told them, but added, "I don't feel comfortable using the public's money because we didn't plan." The position was ultimately struck down entirely when Salgado expressed confidence that the staff could handle the grant writing in-house and motioned to dash the position. The motion passed, with only Ben Yehuda dissenting. That $24,000 gave the city a small cushion for contingencies that might arise, and it will cover a small amount of depreciation expenses if unexpected costs don't come along. Tourism Director Abby Boyd requested a part-time assistant, but pointing at the already tight budget, council ultimately shut down the proposal, with all but Ben Yehuda voting it down. "I know all our departments need help," Mayor Baez said, "but we are short-staffed throughout the city." The council did move $5,000 from the budget for historical preservation of buildings over to professional services to help the tourism department afford cleaning its facilities, which are frequently rented out. The city passed the budget unanimously and then voted all together on a 0.362748 tax per $100, a 13.07% decrease in the tax rate from the previous year. As valuations have climbed in the city, tax rates are able to drop while still collecting a similar or slightly smaller amount of income. Finally, the city approved an agreement with Tyler Technologies to provide Encode software, services, and support for the city of Marfa. Kirk Cunningham of Tyler Technologies, who attended the meeting, said the company could offer improved systems for meter reading and believes that the city's current three-day efforts to do bank reconciliation could be sped up to just 3 hours with his company's software. Billing, utilities, and payroll will all be able to use the software for their work. It is expensive, I get that, but with software you get what you pay for, said Roan, who worked closely with City Hall employees to figure out their software needs. While she spoke with various companies, some came with bad recommendations from cities currently using them, while others were unable to demonstrate functions that the city employees knew they needed. Ben Yehuda asked if the city could use the system while the internet was out, since the information storage will be cloud-based, to which Cunningham said, "You've got to have internet connectivity to connect to the system. If you have a downtime with your internet, we will get involved and help." The contract was approved unanimously, and the new agreement is a recurring cost of $30,634 annually, with the rate fixed for 3 years. It also carries an upfront cost of $73,380 for implementation of the software in the city's system. Mijares. Ernesto G. Mijares, our beloved father, passed away peacefully on September 7, 2021. He was 89 years old. Ernesto was a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. He was born in Bronta, Texas, and resided in Marfa until moving to El Paso in 1968. He attended Marfa High School, where he played football, basketball, and baseball. He was a United States veteran who proudly served in the U.S. Army and later retired as a truck driver after 32 years. Ernesto leaves behind his wife of 64 years, Dominga Mijares, and their 3 children, Linda, Ernest Jr., Sira, and Nick, Lorena, all of El Paso. He is succeeded by 9 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. We could all find comfort knowing Ernesto is now stretching his wings. He had this poem saved at home. I made it home. I just wanted to let you know I made it home. Everything is so pretty here, so white, so fresh, so new. I wish that you could close your eyes so you could see it too. Please try not to be sad for me. Try to understand. God is taking care of me. I'm in the shelter of His hands. Here there is no sadness and no sorrow and no pain. Here there is no crying, and I'll never hurt again. Here it is so peaceful when all angels sing. I really have to go now. I've just got to try my wings. P.S. I'll be the first face you see when you get here. Program will train UTEP Sol Ross students to provide culturally competent mental health care. By UTEP Communications. West Texas. A new partnership between the University of Texas at El Paso, Sol Ross State University in Alpine, Texas, and Preventative Care Health Services in Presidio will develop a behavioral health specialist's workforce to improve access to mental health services in 5 Southwest Texas rural counties. With support from a $1.9 million grant awarded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Health Services Resources Administration to PCHS, also known as Presidio County Health Services, UTEP and Sol Ross will train students to provide culturally competent mental health care to residents of Presidio, Brewster, Culberson, Hudspeth, and Jeff Davis counties. What is significant about this grant is that it will build a behavioral health workforce in 5 rural bi-national Texas counties, which have been designated as medically underserved areas and health professional shortage areas, said Thaneril Mangadu, MD, PhD, UTEP Associate Professor of Public Health Sciences in the College of Health Sciences. The COVID-19 pandemic has affected many people's mental health and increased their risk for substance use disorder, depression, and other behavioral health issues. Our goal is to build an interprofessional healthcare workforce that can address the growing mental health needs of residents in these underserved border communities. This community-engaged program will leverage and expand upon the existing interdisciplinary partnerships of UTEP's Minority AIDS Research Center and a service provision in the Texas Public Health Region 9/10 to build and sustain healthcare workforce capacity. Throughout the next 4 years, 16 UTEP and Sol Ross students will be selected each year for the Rural Behavioral Health Workforce Education and Training Program, BHWET. Program teams will work with community partners in Presidio and surrounding counties to provide students with hands-on practical experiences in local primary care clinics, rehabilitation facilities, and other healthcare organizations. Students who are trained through the program will receive a stipend. Adrian N. Billings, MD, PhD, PCHS Chief Medical Officer, said the program will bring much-needed health services to the rural Big Bend region of Texas, which includes counties with some of the highest mental health professional shortage area scores in the United States. Training of these mental health professional students in these rural and underserved counties will hopefully translate to a workforce pipeline for the Big Bend and similarly under-resourced rural areas so as to decrease mental health care disparities, Billings said. In total, the program will train 64 students who can be recruited to practice professionally in the region after graduation. Barbara Tucker, PhD, Dean of the College of Education and Professional Studies at Sol Ross, said the grant will provide opportunities to reduce mental health disparities in the Big Bend region, which is on the U.S.-Mexico border. As a small university, Sol Ross has limited resources to implement larger grants independently, Tucker said. Our partnership with UTEP has opened the door for Sol Ross to take part in grants such as BHWET, which will also allow us to better serve our students and our community. Segura, a memorial mass for Ron Cosme Segura, who passed away on June 26, 2021, will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, October 9, 2021, during the Valentine High School 2021 reunion. Services will be held at Valentine Sacred Heart Catholic Mission in Valentine, Texas. A gathering for family and friends will be hosted following the Mass at 111 North California Avenue, Valentine. West Texas healthcare providers grapple with new federal mandate requiring staff COVID vaccination, by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas, amid staffing shortages and vaccine hesitancy, some local health care providers are reluctant to implement mandatory vaccine policies ahead of a federal mandate that goes into effect in October. Earlier this month, President Joe Biden announced that vaccines would become mandatory for all staff at health care facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid. That expanded the requirement on nursing homes to now include hospitals, home health care providers, dialysis facilities, and more. failure to comply could lead to the withdrawal of Medicare funding. Meanwhile, Texas Governor Greg Abbott plans to fight the mandate, having already banned public hospitals in the state from enacting vaccine requirement policies. Last week, the Big Bend Regional Medical Center, the only hospital within the Tri-County area, announced it is taking new federal requirements seriously and have begun efforts to comply, hospital spokesperson Ruth Huck said. The facility is privately owned by Quorum Health and not subject to Abbott's bans. Big Bend Regional Medical Center supports COVID-19 vaccines as one of the most effective measures against the pandemic, Huck said. As we have throughout the pandemic, we continue to monitor developments and follow federal guidelines. Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, which receives transfer patients from the Tri-County and has recently served Presidio and Alpine residents hospitalized with COVID-19, has been more reluctant to implement the mandate. In a letter to employees, Russell Tippin, the Medical Center Health System president and CEO, who oversees MCH in Odessa, wrote, "While we highly encourage all of our employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19, more than 60% are fully vaccinated. This is not a decision that we want to be forced upon our employees by federal leadership. As a healthcare facility that receives Medicare and Medicaid funding, not complying with this mandate would put us in a dire financial situation," Tippin wrote. It was a message echoed by others, including Preventative Care Health Services CEO Linda Molinar. "The majority of our patients are using Medicaid and Medicare. To lose those patients, it's not an option. Those patients are the reason we're here," she said in an interview last week. PCHS, a federally qualified health center that has clinics in Alpine, Marfa, and Presidio, is also waiting for the final implementation of the new rule to decide how to proceed. "We currently don't require our staff to be vaccinated," said Molinar. While she said most of the staff are vaccinated, "We're still waiting for the last ruling to see what they say, so we can come up with some kind of policy to put in place. We don't force our staff or require them." Tippin of MCH isn't just waiting for the final directive, however. The Odessa Hospital plans to exhaust all of our resources to determine how to approach this situation, and a final decision has not been made by hospital leadership and the Ector County Hospital District's Board of Directors. "We are already in the process of consulting with legal experts, as well as local, state, and federal agencies, to determine our rights and abilities under this federal mandate," Tippin told employees. Other privately run facilities in the Tri-County area, like the Marfa Clinic and Agave Home Health, were already in compliance when the mandate was announced, with their staff fully vaccinated. Cynthia Kirkpatrick, the clinical manager for Agave Home Health, said, "I can tell you that we actually are fully vaccinated, and we had done that prior to that order. It was all on a volunteer basis. Everyone was great. They just stepped up and volunteered." In contrast to some of the smaller facilities, those with a larger share of employees have struggled with vaccination rates and maintaining a full staff during the pandemic. "During the most recent surge in cases, we experienced the same staffing concerns as hospitals around the country," said Huck of BBRMC. Molinar concurred, saying that the already existing staffing shortage in her facilities could be exacerbated with the new mandate. "We have a staff shortage, so if there's another requirement on top of everything, Of course, it's going to get more difficult, she said. Tippin shared the concern. We understand that this mandate would affect roughly 40% of our employees, and if forced upon us, we know that we would inevitably lose a valuable portion of our staff, a loss that would be unimaginable in our current shorthanded situation, he wrote earlier this month. Another shared sentiment among the facilities is an uncertainty about how it will be implemented. Tippin believed there would be no alternative option like regularly scheduled testing for those refusing the vaccine. Huck said BBRMC was unclear if there will be a weekly testing alternative or other exception to the federal requirement, as our many states allow. More information is expected to arrive in October to clarify. Molinar of PCHS said, I hope we don't lose anybody, and I hope it doesn't affect recruiting, but we don't have a choice. The facility relies so heavily on Medicare and Medicaid patients that to lose that funding would be too dire a consequence. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, will issue an interim final rule with a comment period in October, expecting healthcare workers and support staff to immediately begin the process of getting vaccinated, if not already. There is no question that staff, across any healthcare setting, who remain unvaccinated, pose both direct and indirect threats to patient safety and population health, said U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra in a news release about the coming mandate. Ensuring safety and access to all patients, regardless of their entry point into the healthcare system, is essential. The White House's new directive comes during the continued spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19 throughout the United States. According to the Texas Tribune, on average, over 250 Texans have died every day for the past 30 days from COVID-19. According to CMS, data shows that higher vaccination rates among healthcare providers and staff correlate to lower infection rates among patients who see them for care. Now is the time to act, said CMS Administrator Chiquita Brooks-LaSueur. I'm urging everyone, but especially those fighting this virus on the front lines, to get vaccinated and protect themselves, their families, and their patients from COVID-19.
Hi. This is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, September 30th, 2021. New rec centers discussed at meeting by Nathan Hewer. Two potential new recreation facilities in Fort Stockton were at the center of discussion at an Intergovernmental Recreation Board meeting on September 22nd. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster, FSISD School Board Member Flo Garcia, Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander, Fort Stockton City Councilman Paul Casillas, and Recreation Director Ruby Bernal were in attendance in official capacity. Director and football coach Mike Peters and Superintendent Gabriel Zamora were also in attendance. Park Hill, a firm that provides architectural and engineering design services that the three entities previously hired to do multiple assessments earlier in the year, presented two projects that were comparable to the city and county's desires for a facility. Caldwell ISD Competition Gymnasium and the Melissa ISD Inboard Facility were presented to the board. Caldwell's facility was $6.5 million and featured multiple basketball courts and volleyball courts. The Melissa ISD facility was largely an indoor turf facility that was 125,000 square feet, costing $21 million. Following the presentation, Garcia asked other board members how much of a facility Fort Stockton needs. I'm with Flo, Schuster said. I think we need a footprint and then put the pencil to it to figure out what the cost is, because if you start with a figure, you're never going to need the footprint. If you can't afford it, that's when you start downsizing. Schuster continued with an idea that drew no objection from those in attendance. The county judge stated his idea of having an approximately 80,000 square foot football facility built north of the high school in the current area the district holds bonfires. I can see getting multiple use out of it with a school for both football and other sports with bad weather, batting cages, marching bands, etc. Schuster also thought a second facility with basketball volleyball courts at the intermediate school or the old Alamo school should be in consideration. The facility would be considerably less in size and hold up to 4 basketball courts, which could translate into 8 volleyball courts. I'm really optimistic at looking at both of these, he said. The reason I say this is that we're going to build something. We're going to get a lot of use for a lot of years out of it. It's not just for this generation, but for several generations to come. I know what a lot of schools are going with indoor turf football fields on school campuses, and so on and so forth. I don't think our school should be any different. Dr. Zamora followed by saying that before facility specifics are determined in terms of location, size, and features, Park Hill needs to follow through on what they originally agreed to do. The agreement, according to the school board minutes from their July meeting, stated for the scope of services, this project consists of a facility needs assessment for instructional facilities, a technology and security assessment, and a recreation center feasibility study. Zamora said that he would follow up with Park Hill in the coming days. At this point, there's a bunch of awesome ideas and what I'm hoping they would do to consolidate. So the intermediate is nothing more than a possibility for the location of a new facility. What my concept was, they were going to evaluate what we currently have in place, the baseball fields, everything, and then look at running some surveys, working with the rec board to establish what we need, and then to help determine the best placement, whether it's a split facility or not. This is a developing story and will be followed upon further with information made available. Murder case to go to the grand jury by Nathan Heuer. A murder charge against a Fort Stockton teen, Andrew Pacheco, 18, in the death of Edward Ramirez, will go to a grand jury in October in Pecos County, according to 83rd District Attorney Ori White. White confirmed that the autopsy of Ramirez was completed in the last few weeks, and a 12-person grand jury will decide whether to issue a true bill or no bill. What happens in grand jury, the main investigator is sworn in, and he tells the grand jury what his investigation revealed. If 9 of them feel that the crime was committed and there's 9 that vote positive, what that does is move the case into district court in front of a district judge. Flu shots available in the city by Nathan Heuer. Flu shots are currently available in Fort Stockton and can be received at Walmart, Dr. Malik's office, and at Cactus Health Services. Appointments must be scheduled at Malik's and Cactus Health. Patients will be charged for visits at these locations. Walmart accepts walk-in patients, with the shot being free to those with insurance. Pecos County Memorial Hospital will begin giving out flu shots next week at their Family Care Walk-In Center located on Main Street. The shot is $25 at their facility. Appointments are not needed at the walk-in clinic. Fort Stockton Public Library to receive new computers by Megan Waring. Through an anonymous donation of $25,000, the Fort Stockton Public Library is set to purchase new computers. That's a very generous contribution to the library, said Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. The donation was accepted at Monday's Commissioner's Court meeting. The library currently offers free computer use and internet access to the community with 10 regular workstations, 2 children-only workstations, and an ADA-compliant workstation. The number of new computers that will be purchased was not provided. At its September 27th meeting, the Pecos County Commissioners Court scheduled the county cleanup for November 8th through the November 19th. This will take place after the Fort Stockton fall cleanup. Crews will be sweeping streets and alleys countywide through every precinct for bulky items during regular working hours from 7 to 4 p.m. Wood, appliances, and furniture will need to be separated, while household trash and tires will not be accepted. We take our items to the city's landfill, Schuster said. They don't charge us for it during that period of time. We pick up trash items that are put out by those people who live outside of Fort Stockton. The county will release staff to help with Fort Stockton cleanup, and the city will also release staff to help the county, according to City Manager Frank Rodriguez. The landfill is located at 3400 Stone Road, north of Interstate 10 and east of Farm to Market 1053. City to lease new compactor. The Fort Stockton City Council approved the lease agreement for a new waste compactor at its regular meeting held on September 28th. The city will acquire an 816 landfill compactor for $8,662 monthly, which equates to almost $104,000 yearly, from Caterpillar through the Cat Value Option Lease Agreement. With the recommendation from Public Works Director Aaron Ramos, Council decided to replace the current compactor that was originally purchased in 2014. The current compactor has had some serious maintenance issues, said Jesse Gonzalez. With the move to the new landfill approaching, the need for a compactor that operates is more imminent now than ever. The lease includes 1,500 hours allotted annually for a total of 7,500 hours. The compactor will have full machine warranty for 5 years. The machine is essential in the operations at the landfill with 25 to 30 hours of weekly use. The compactor has two functions: to spread the waste evenly in layers and to compact the waste to reduce its volume and help stabilize the landfill. Some of the benefits for waste compaction are to have better site hygiene, safety, and improve landfill efficiency by not using too much of the landfill. Due to setbacks from the pandemic, the city would not receive the new compactor until approximately March of 2022. Caterpillar typically has the machine in stock at the factory, but currently does not have any.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, September 23rd. Sinclair booked for stealing and selling copper. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Ward County Sheriff's deputies have arrested a man who was identified as the individual who stole more than $9,000 worth of copper wiring from the Permian power plant. Bobby Shane Sinclair, age 33, of Monahans, was booked into the Ward County Jail on the warrant and charged with theft of property equal to or less than $2,500, but not greater than $30,000, a state felony. According to Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle, quote, the report of the stolen copper came in around 8 a.m. on August 26th. One of our deputies had been at Monahan's Iron and Metal the day before the report came in about the stolen copper and had been told by employees they received some copper recently that they had never seen before, he said. The recycling plant is required by law to keep records of anyone dropping off recyclable materials. Quote, based on those records, we had a name, so when the report came in the next day of the stolen copper, the deputy knew Sinclair had taken the copper to the recycling plant, he added. A warrant was issued for Sinclair's arrest, and he was subsequently arrested on September 18th. His bond was set at $5,000, and he was released after posting the bond. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of not more than 2 years or less than 180 days, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Eddie Foster to be honored on Saturday. A tribute for Edward Eddie J. Foster is scheduled for Saturday, September 25th, beginning at 1:30 p.m. at the Heritage Museum of the Ward County Million Barrel Museum. Foster's wife, Kim, will be present to present artifacts to the museum as a tribute to the legendary Monahans football player. Foster is the only Texan to be selected as All-State and four different positions over 2 years in the early 1970s. He was inducted into the Texas High School Football Hall of Fame in 2013. He was captain of the University of Oklahoma 1973 undefeated Big Eight championship team. He also played in the Canadian Football League and the World Football League. Foster passed away on May 15, 2015. His wife will be present to present artifacts such as his Monahans High School letter jacket and other memorabilia, as well as some of her own artifacts from the state volleyball team. Celebration of Life for Abels Saturday. A celebration of life for legendary Monahans coach Paul Abels will be held this Saturday, September 25th, beginning at 3:30 p.m. at the Ward County Event Center. The community is invited to attend and share thoughts, stories, memories, and life lessons of the coach. Refreshments will be served. Two 50-50 raffles will be held. The first will be at the homecoming game on Friday night, and the second at the Celebration of Life. Prizes are a Ruger American Predator 6.0 Creedmoor rifle, a 3-day, 2-doe hunt, gift cards. All money raised will go towards scholarships. For further information, contact Kimberly Abels at 432-661-7711. 4-H agent adapting to new role. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A native of New Mexico, Kaylee Gillespie is finding Ward County and its residents to her liking. She is the new Agriculture and Natural Resources agent for the Ward County 4-H. She is new to the job, having arrived in Ward County in June after graduating from New Mexico State University in Las Cruces in May. She received her Bachelor of Science degree in Animal Science this May. She explained that there are two distinct branches in the animal science discipline, the animal industry path and the scientific path. She explained the differences. Quote, "I studied in the animal industry path, which is more the commercial side of the discipline. The other path, the scientific path, is more directed to those going for veterinary-type degrees," she said. Things have moved fast for the Monahans newcomer. Not only is she new to her job, the 4-H office has moved to new quarters at 3399 South Stockton Avenue on the grounds of the Ward County Coliseum. The new building is a manufactured home, and the two agents, Gillespie and Haley Lacaz, and Staff Secretary Marcy Bernal, are still busy getting the new facility all set up. But the new location is open for business. Phone number is unchanged at 432-943-2682. Lacaz is the 4-H Family and Community Health Agent. While the duties are significantly different, the two work closely together and help each other as much as possible. Gillespie graduated from Santa Fe High School in 2017. Her parents still make their home there. Her mother is in appliance sales, and dad is an appliance repairman. She has a brother who is 5 years older. Kaylee and her brother were both involved in 4-H while growing up. Quote, "My family was very supportive of everything I wanted to do. My big brother was a tremendous help," she said. The duties of an agriculture and natural resources agent are extensive. Some of the duties include working with farmers, ranchers, and communities to help improve productivity. An extensive program is aimed at the youth of the county, but works with the adult community as well. A big part of her duties is working with school-aged children in preparing and raising livestock for the annual 4-H show, held every January. Quote, "Here, it is just the livestock show. In New Mexico, we made posters, arts and crafts displays, and other activities to enhance the stock show. In addition to ranches in Ward County, there are a lot of home ranches, which includes chickens, gardens, pecans, rabbits, and more. We help provide instruction on watering, pruning, fertilizer, animal feed, and care," she said. She also noted that the cattle market, quote, "costs are going up, but the rain this year has helped, so less feed needs to be purchased. Also, prices are going up," end quote. One of the upcoming events, especially since there is a great deal of rangeland in the area, is an agricultural multi-county virtual training designed to help area ranchers. There is also an agricultural committee meeting in October, which will seek input from the community. Despite her young age, Kaylee is well-rounded, having engaged in numerous 4-H activities. She took first in New Mexico State 4-H competition showing sheep and goats. She also competed in the National Stock Show in Denver, Colorado. Shooting sports are also part of her repertoire. She went to nationals in air gun pistols and muzzle loaders. Quote, "I love muzzle loaders. They are so much fun," end quote. She is also involved in numerous baking projects and even studied welding in high school. Additionally, she enjoys hunting elk and deer. She was able to find a house to rent and said her landlady, quote, "is awesome. The community has given me a very warm welcome. I want to continue to make things better for the residents of the county. I'm glad to be here and anxious to see what I can do for the county," she concluded. Drilling activity still rising, gas prices up. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Generally, drilling activity in the Permian Basin, in both Texas, New Mexico, and nationally, continues to show a slow but steady increase based on the September 17 data from Baker Hughes Corporation. The immediate area is also showing modest gains. Eastern New Mexico leads the Permian Basin with 82 active rigs, 53 in Lee County, and 29 in Eddy County. Lee County leads production in the Permian Basin. The Texas side of the basin is up by 7 to 177. The Permian Basin total was 259, up by 10 over the August 27th report, and the national count has increased by 4 to 512. Midland County fluctuates from 37 at the beginning of June to 28 on September 17th. Reeves County has declined from 23 to 21. Loving County dropped by 16 to 15 active rigs. Andrews County is up by 1 to 3, and Pecos County is unchanged at 3, and Ector County is up by 1 to 2 active rigs. Ward County has 9 rigs, the highest level since April 2020. Winkler County is unchanged at 2, and Crane County is unchanged at 2. Prices for West Texas Intermediate crude were at $70.46 per barrel on Tuesday. Price 3 weeks ago, according to oilprice.com, was $69.16. In an article from oilprice.com, Charles Kennedy stated, quote, "Even after 2050, global oil demand is set to continue to rise because renewables cannot entirely replace fossil fuels," energy markets expert Anas Alhaj said during a recent energy conference hosted by Nigeria. Quote, "The impact of climate change policies on oil demand are highly exaggerated. The impact is mostly on demand growth, not on demand itself," Alhaj said during a keynote speech at the event focused on the impact of the energy transition on oil-dependent economies, as carried by Nigerian outlet Energy Frontier. With fall beginning this week, regular unleaded gasoline has increased slightly. As of Tuesday, the national average has increased by about 4 cents, from $3.15 per gallon to $3.19, according to AAA. The Texas average has increased from $2.78 to $2.80. Ector County increased from $2.98 to $3.02, and Reeves County is up from $3.03 to $3.07. Winkler County increased from $2.85 to $2.90 per gallon. Pecos County was at $3.06 and is now at $3.08. Crane County is the only county that has stayed the same at $2.86, which is also the lowest in the area. Ward County increased only slightly from $3.01 to $3.02.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.